Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 318, side A, titled Kidding Around, Pedophilia and Organized Child Molestation in the Republican Party. This is being recorded on July 29th of the year 2001, and as I'm speaking, much of the national news coverage in the past several weeks and even a couple of months has dealt with the affair between Gary Condit, a Modesto congressman, a Democrat, and not incidentally also a political ally of Gray Davis of California, and a woman named Chandra Levy, who was an intern and last working, by the way, with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Ms. Levy has disappeared, and Gary Condit has dissembled about an affair that they had. There has been no formal investigative link that I'm aware of between her death and the affair, but it certainly was not the most discreet thing in the world for Gary Condit to have done, and his dissembling about it has certainly deepened the heat that is on him. What has not received any substantive coverage by the national media is a very clear and very disturbing indication of not only pedophilia on the part of powerful members of the Republican Party, but organized pedophilia, and in many cases even gay pedophilia. That should not be misunderstood as being homophobic, but rather with the strong influence of the Christian right and their homophobia. The fact that numerous and powerful elements of the Republican Party are not only pedophiles, but gay pedophiles at that, and that this pedophilia is done in an organized fashion and has apparent connections to the first Bush administration, and indeed the name of the Bush family crops up in connection with this investigation in a number of respects. I think that the focus of the news media on the Gary Condit case is rather myopic and hypocritical. An article emerged this past week which may be connected to the investigation that we're going to be going into, something called the Franklin cover-up. That, by the way, the title of a book by a conservative Nebraska state legislator, himself a Republican and a decorated Vietnam veteran, a fellow named John W. DeCamp. Whether there's any connection between the case that I'm about to read about and the information that's going to be occupying the bulk of the broadcast today, I cannot say directly. I do think that that is an interesting question to ask. Most newspapers carried no account whatsoever of the following. One of the few papers to carry this account was the New York Times of Friday, July 27th of the year 2001. This article is by David M. Hershenhorn, H-E-R-S-Z-E-N-H-O-R-N, at Stateline, New Haven, Connecticut, July 26th. Headline, Connecticut Mayor is Arrested by U.S. Agents in Child Sex Case. Compare the coverage of the Condit case with the virtual black news blackout on this one. Mayor Philip A. Giordano, G-I-O-R-D-A-N-O, of Waterbury, Connecticut, who lost a long-shot bid last year to unseat Senator Joseph I. Lieberman, and whose city has been teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, was arrested in New Haven this morning by federal agents in New Haven and accused of luring a minor for sex. Federal officials were unwilling to provide significant detail about the two charges filed against Mr. Giordano, 38, in United States District Court in Bridgeport, and the complaint against him was sealed by Judge Alan H. Nevis at the request of Mr. Giordano's public defender, Thomas G. Dennis. At a news conference at the office of the United States Attorney for Connecticut in New Haven, officials said Mr. Giordano had engaged in inappropriate sex, unquote, with, quote, children, unquote. Though they did not state the number, age, or sex of the victims. The special agent in charge of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Connecticut, Michael J. Wolfe, said, quote, the public expects and deserves utmost honesty, integrity, and strong moral fiber from those who serve on their behalf, unquote. He called Mr. Giordano's conduct disgraceful, unquote. Well, who exactly the children were, just what kind of sex he was engaged in, obviously remains a matter of speculation since the case has been sealed. I would note, skipping down on the story, United States Attorney for Connecticut John A. Danaher III said Mr. Giordano had been charged with, quote, use of an interstate facility to entice a minor under the age of 16 to engage in sexual activity, unquote, and conspiracy to commit that offense. So apparently Giordano was working with somebody else. I would also note this arrest took place in New Haven, which is, of course, where Yale University and the Skull and Bones are located. Yale University and Skull and Bones are George W.'s alma mater, though I'm not stating that there's necessarily any connection. I'm also not stating that there's not necessarily any connection. Skull and Bones is into some pretty kinky stuff, ranging from, at least in some cases, grave robbing on the part of Prescott Bush Sr., who robbed Geronimo's grave. grave to some very, very interesting initiation rituals indeed, and we discussed an eyewitness account of the initiation ritual in For the Record program number 308. Whether or not there's anything more to this case than we've been told in this article, I do think that, first of all, the relative lack of interest in the on the part of the news media in this case is worth noting. This guy ran against Democratic vice presidential nominee Joseph Lieberman, challenged him for his Senate seat. And I would also note that pedophilia and organized pedophilia, and I would note that Mr. Giordano has been charged with conspiracy in this case, are in fact epidemic in the Republican Party, and the source in that could not be in any way mislabeled as the, quote, liberal news media, unquote, because indeed, that source is a paperback book written by a conservative Republican Nebraska state legislator named John W. DeCamp, last name capital D-E, capital C-A-M-P. And I don't know whether DeCamp is still serving in the Nebraska state legislature. He is a lawyer, a very conservative individual, one who earned the respect of both political allies and opponents. He was a decorated infantry captain in Vietnam, and while in Vietnam, he worked with William Colby, the former director of the CIA. And DeCamp has published a book about his long and very harrowing investigation into organized pedophilia in the Republican Party. That book is called The Franklin Cover-Up. It was published in soft cover by AWT Incorporated, copyright 1992. The second edition is copyright 1996, the ISBN number 0-963-215-8-0-9. This particular book deals with, again, among other things, organized pedophilia and child molestation within the Republican Party, much of it, oddly enough, gay pedophilia and child molestation. I would also add that there are evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of some of the federal government's mind control programs, and indeed Satanism as a cover for some of these activities, something that I dealt with in, among other broadcasts, the miscellaneous archive series The Ultimate Evil, done in 1987 and 88. This particular investigation began with the failure of the Franklin Credit Union in Nebraska, and after that case was investigated, a number of interesting evidentiary tributaries came to light. As we will see during the course of the broadcast, one of those major evidentiary tributaries runs in the direction of the Iran-Contra scandal, and indeed there were allegations that some of the funds that were missing from the Franklin Credit Union wound up going to help support the illegal Contra effort. There are numerous connections between a fellow named Larry King, not to be confused with a talk show host of the same name. Larry King was an African-American Republican in Nebraska, and at least until this case emerged, one of the rising young stars in the Republican Party. Larry King was one of the top officials with the Franklin Credit Union, and as the investigation into the failure of Franklin Credit Union began to unravel, a widespread pattern of organized pedophilia, allegedly organized by Larry King, emerged, and in this particular book, that the story of that investigation is detailed. It is quite apparent that that investigation went to the highest levels of the corridors of power, and that for that reason, the investigation was attenuated and covered up. Hence the title of the book, The Franklin Cover-Up. I would note with regard to this book that the second edition has a number of elements in some of its supplemental writings that I think are very dubious. It's obvious that this book, first of all, Mr. DeCamp's work was ignored by the mainstream press and for the most part by the progressive media. In the 1990s, DeCamp obviously fell under the sway of the militia movement, a more complex phenomenon than has generally been represented. And as such, some of the appendices to the second edition of this book have some very questionable material, including some endorsements of elements that I would consider to be outright fascist. However, that was the second edition of the book. The main body of this book is not only credible, but very, very important indeed. And I think John DeCamp deserves a major tip of the hat from Sincerely Patriotic Americans for his very heroic investigation. And I would note in this regard, too, that much of the instigation for his investigation came from his close friend, the late CIA director William Colby, who may very well have been working with a faction of the intelligence community that was supporting Bill Clinton against the onslaught of attacks that beset Bill Clinton. In the introduction to the second edition of the book, there is a dedication by John DeCamp to his friend Bill Colby, and that dedication goes as follows. It is a little over 4 years since I, John DeCamp, wrote the words you have just read. This is the first part of the book, and then there's a second supplemental section, much of which I think is quite dubious, some of which is quite good. But it's worth noting that in the introduction to the second section, DeCamp credits Bill Colby. It is a little over 4 years since I, John DeCamp, wrote the words you have just read. My closest friend and mentor, Bill Colby, like so many others in the Franklin case, is dead. He was fished out of a river in front of his home under the most questionable of circumstances in April of 1996. Was he killed because of his involvement in Franklin? I don't know. What I do know is that Bill Colby was the heart and soul of the Franklin investigation. Although at a certain point he warned me against investigating the case further, it was he who relentlessly pushed to publicly expose what had already been discovered when everyone else, including at times myself, wanted to call it quits. Without him, this book would never have been written. Indeed, although we're not going to have time to go into this, one of the things that Bill Colby pointed out about the militia and patriot movement was that one of the reasons it was so significant is that many of these people had police and military experience, and that they had worked for the government, and then when they found out some of the rotten things the government had been involved in, they felt betrayed, and that if this movement were misunderstood, it could possibly be misused against the United States, possibly by a hostile foreign power. Hold that for future reference. Interestingly enough, not only was Bill Colby, the late William Colby, a strong supporter of Bill Clinton, but his wife had a senior position in the Clinton administration. Turning once again to the Franklin cover-up, speaking of Colby, John DeCamp writes, not only was Bill's wife, Sally Shelton Colby, in a senior position in the Clinton administration, but Colby himself had emphasized to me repeatedly that Clinton was a great president and that it was urgent that he be reelected. And I would note, too, he warned John W. DeCamp about Ambrose Evans Pritchard, a British journalist with whom he was going to meet. And that warning went, his name is Ambrose Evans Pritchard. And he said, be very careful, unquote. That warning to John W. DeCamp when he expressed interest in meeting with Pritchard. I would note that Pritchard was a fierce critic of Bill Clinton's. What we're going to do for the duration of the broadcast is to examine the very disturbing evidence of organized pedophilia and even gay pedophilia within the Republican Party, and evidentiary tributaries that are surfaced in these allegations go to the highest levels of the Republican Party, including in the direction of the elder George Bush and also members of his family. Once again, this investigation began with the failure of the Franklin Credit Union, and as that failure was investigated, it became apparent that many, many people, average citizens in the state of Nebraska, had become aware of the organized child molestation that was allegedly being conducted by Larry King. And the evidentiary tributaries in this case ran to the highest corridors of power in Washington, D.C., and the most powerful elements of the Republican Party, including those that were headed by George W. Bush, and as we're going to see, George H.W. Bush, including, as we will see later in the broadcast, evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the Iran-Contra scandal, and George H.W. Bush, George the First, as I call him, Big George, as opposed to Little George, who's in Washington now, Big George was the loop. He not only wasn't out of the loop in Iran-Contra, he was the loop, and in my opinion, probably the single most powerful individual in Washington, D.C. in the past quarter of a century, possibly more than that. After discussing the circumstances surrounding the Franklin Credit Union and detailing some of the profound evidence against Larry King concerning the allegations of organized child molestation, John DeCamp goes on to write about the evidentiary tributaries running in the directions of the corridors of power. We're going to begin with Chapter 13, The Washington Connection. John DeCamp writes, in December 1990, Senator Schmidt recalled an incident from almost exactly 2 years earlier, before the Franklin Committee was officially established. It was rather strange, Schmidt said. The first day that I decided to introduce the resolution for a legislative investigation, that by the Nebraska State Legislature, while the resolution was being drafted, I was cautioned by an unknown person by telephone that I was advised not to pursue the investigation because it would lead, I was told, to the highest levels of the Republican Party. And I responded that the investigation would go where it went, unquote. Hard as the Omaha business community worked to distance itself from Larry King, there were even more strenuous efforts to insulate from the scandal anybody of national stature with whom King had consorted. There was a lot to hide. In the Republican Party, King had a meteoric rise. He sang the Star-Spangled Banner at a National Black Republican Council event in 1982, where President and Mrs. Reagan were the guest of honor. By 1984, it was the GOP's National Convention that heard the national anthem from Larry King. There, in Dallas, he hosted his extravagant party at South Fork Ranch, where I saw Maureen Reagan draped over King all evening like a big blanket. Maureen Reagan, by the way, now suffering from advanced cancer. Continuing. In 1988, at the Republican National Convention in New Orleans, King sang again. He made a 10-minute Get Out the Vote video on behalf of Bush for the 1988 campaign. The Omaha Star, newspaper of the city's black community, chronicled the rise in politics of Larry King. In his Political Viewpoint column of November 24, 1983, Ernest E. Bryant addressed why King was unable to stand for re-election as chairman of the Nebraska Frederick Douglass Republican Council. Chairman King has accepted a position in the Reagan-Bush re-election campaign. He was appointed by National Black Republican Council Chairperson LeGree Daniels, who was named chairperson of the black voters for the campaign in the Reagan-Bush 84 re-election bid. She has appointed King as coordinator of all the activities to bring out the black vote. In brief, this means that Mr. King will be responsible for meeting with the party officials and the black Republican leadership within each of the 17 targeted states. He will coordinate the efforts of these groups in support of the Reagan-Bush campaign. Mr. King will also be traveling to the 17 targeted states when President Reagan does to draw state party officials and black Republican leadership together. Mr. King has also accepted the chairmanship of the National Black Republican Council Development Committee for Fundraising. And that again from the Omaha Star, the newspaper for Omaha's African American community. Continuing. Stepping inside the Franklin Credit Union, visitors were greeted by a 4-foot-high picture of Larry King with Ronald Reagan. King's backers in the Omaha business community have plenty of ties to Washington, since Nebraska has been a favorite stomping ground for the national GOP. Although its population is just 1.6 million, the concentration of corporate wealth in the state makes it a priority for fundraising, with the attendant political and business back and forth. Peter Kiewit, K-I-E-W-I-T and Sons, for instance, contributed $100,000 to elect Richard Nixon and later got the contract to build the subway system for the nation's capital. During the 1990 gubernatorial campaign, George Bush called Republican Kay Orr's re-election bid the most important race in the country. Bush visited Nebraska 3 times and adds in parentheses, Orr lost. On the morning of February 7, 1990, Larry King was making plans to attend one of those fundraising events in Omaha featuring President George Bush. Out of the blue, U.S. Magistrate Richard Kopf suddenly ordered King to be taken to a federal psychiatric facility in Springfield, Missouri for, quote, tests, unquote. Senator Chambers reacted to King's abrupt disappearance as reported in the March 17, 1990 World Herald. State Senator Ernie Chambers said Friday that he believes that Franklin Community Federal Credit Union head Lawrence E. King was whisked out of Omaha, quote, in a hasty, almost clandestine way last month, so he could not attend an event at which President Bush spoke. I would add parenthetically, the Franklin case and all of the scandalous allegations contained in it was already major news in Nebraska when Bush made this appearance. Continuing. Chambers said that a trial of King could prove embarrassing to, quote, powerful people at the national level, unquote. The notes of Franklin investigator Gary Caradori, C-A-R-A-D-O-R-I, confirm the senator's suspicions. On February 19, 1990, 12 days after King was whisked off, Caradori wrote, I was informed that L.K. was sent to Missouri for observation because the Secret Service had discovered that he had purchased a ticket to Governor Orr's breakfast with President Bush. L.K. was approached at a local floral shop and was rushed to court by the Secret Service or at their demand. This was so sudden that L.K.'s attorneys were unaware of what was going on. The word in Omaha was that King, indicted in federal court May 19, 1989, on 40 counts of financial wrongdoing, was planning to ask Bush for help. When Larry King traveled the political circuit, he evidently had 2 agendas. To the public, he was the rising GOP star with the resonant baritone voice. Something else went on behind closed doors. At the Dallas Convention in 1984, King threw his splashy party at South Fork Ranch, remembered by me and many other delegates as an unparalleled extravaganza. According to several child victim witnesses, he also arranged some private events during the convention. They recall being flown to Dallas to be used sexually by convention-goers. Gary Caradore mapped the recollections of the Webb foster children, by the way, those are some of the children that were molested, allegedly, in this, in his notes of February 28, 1990. Quote, "During their visit, the children's aunt Marcy informed social worker Joni that the youngest Patterson Webb sister Kendra had told her that she had been transported around the country several times, she thought to Texas and Louisiana. Marcy remembered Texas in particular and a Republican convention because one of the children, possibly Kendra, had a book of matches from Texas, and that is how the children had known where they were at. Joni stated she remembered that the children had been exploited sexually in Texas, and she indicated that it was the feeling that this activity had been going on for several years." Then John DeCamp goes on to describe the recollections of Paul Bonacci, who appears to have been a victim of mind control as well as long-term sexual abuse by adults in the Republican Party. And one of the points that he notes is that Paul Bonacci's recollections of the physical details of the South Fork Party were absolutely impeccable, and that there's no way that he could possibly have recalled the details of the event itself if he had not been there. And remember that John W. DeCamp, again a decorated infantry captain in Vietnam, was at this very same party, though not part of the sexual improprieties, and so his recollection of the South Fork Party was very strong, and he could compare the physical details recalled by Paul Bonacci with his own firsthand recollections, and that was one of the fundamental bases for his account of the South Fork Party here. DeCamp writes, "I was later to learn from Paul Bonacci that he was also at the famed South Fork Party. He described it for me in exact detail some 7 years after the party took place. He had been there for the purpose of providing sexual favors for people Larry King wanted to accommodate, satisfy, or compromise. Paul said he was one of a troop of teenaged boys and girls whom King had shipped to Dallas for his purposes. I have talked to Paul repeatedly about this party. I have listened to his description. Only by having been there could someone describe the setting the way Paul did to me, because I was there myself for the party. I am certain that Paul Bonacci was there and did not invent his story or his description of the party. This was, it happens, just one of Paul's leads into matters surrounding Larry King and Franklin that I could personally check out and know the boy was telling the truth. Not because somebody told me he was telling the truth, not because somebody said he passed a lie detector on the subject, but because I was there and saw a part of it and saw the exact same things this boy did." By the way, I would add that Paul Bonacci and a number of the other alleged victim witnesses actually passed polygraph tests, and there are numerous other details to corroborate what they had to say. Nonetheless, they themselves were charged and in some cases convicted of criminal activity and their testimony discounted, and the powerful who were engaged apparently in this type of abuse were protected by the results of the Franklin cover-up. Continuing. "Again, in 1988, attendance at Larry King's party was virtually mandatory for any true Nebraska Republican attending the Republican National Convention, held this time in New Orleans. Most of the Nebraska delegation was transported to the party by bus. The theme of the festivities was Mardi Gras. With me was my 12-year-old daughter Jennifer, who met a black youth named Prince at the party. 'Look, Daddy, that boy's name is Prince King. Isn't that a funny name?' Jenny said to me as she looked at the name tag of the son of the man sponsoring the party, Larry King. Everybody had a name tag pinned on immediately upon entering the party. I am sure that, again, Larry King had youth at that party whose sexual favors were used as gifts for this or that politician or businessman. King's parties were designed to bring in everybody from the innocent to the top-ranking businessmen and politicians. I personally attended the two largest parties he ever threw, as did many Republican officials. As a guest at the party, you would not know from the outer glitter what sordid activity was going on behind the scenes. I am sure that was the character of many of Larry King's parties, particularly the political events. Outwardly, they have the appearance of legitimacy, with prominent people in attendance from mayors to presidents, from businessmen to congressmen. So when people say to me, 'Well, I was at one of Larry King's parties, and I did not see any of this sex or drug or pedophilia stuff,' I understand that they may be speaking with honesty and accuracy. As to what really went on, I believe that they are wrong." Larry King spent his money far and wide and not just in Nebraska. One of the places he rented was a house for $5,000 a month off Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., which formerly housed the Brazilian legation to the Organization of American States. When Larry entertained, it was a hot ticket, said a public relations man King hired, quoted by Rick Horning and Michael Casey in the February 28, 1989 Village Voice. Virtually every high-ranking black member of the Republican administration had been out to lunch, over for drinks, or at a dinner party. The food and drink were first rate, as was the mix of people, black, white, Republican, Democrat, young and old. For King, the emphasis was on the young. King acquired contacts in Washington's homosexual prostitution scene, one of whom was the late Craig Spence. A lobbyist and political operative, Spence maintained a callboy ring that catered to the political elite, and unlike most D.C. callboy rings, offered children to its clients. Spence's activities made banner headlines in the Washington Times on June 29, 1989. Quote, "Homosexual prostitution inquiry ensnares VIPs with Reagan and Bush," unquote. Spence's access was so good that he could arrange nighttime tours of the White House for his clients. The Times added on August 9, 1989, that Spence, quote, "hinted the tours were arranged by top-level persons, including Donald Gregg, National Security Advisor to Vice President Bush," unquote. Spence, according to friends, was also carrying out homosexual blackmail operations for the CIA. According to a Washington, D.C. investigative journalist who researched the Spence ring, quote, "The way we discovered Larry King and this Nebraska-based callboy ring was by looking through the credit card chits of Spence's ring where we found King's name. Another investigator with personal knowledge of the callboy rings operating in Washington put it this way. Larry King and Craig Spence were business partners. Look at two companies, Dream Boys and Man to Man, both of which operated under another service, Bodies by God," unquote. When Craig Spence turned up dead, a suicide, police were quick to say, in a Boston hotel room in November of 1989, it was the latest in the long string of deaths of persons linked to the Iran-Contra covert operations and funding. There is evidence that Larry King had Washington business in that area as well. Quote, "In the 6.5 months since federal authorities closed Franklin, rumors have persisted that money from the credit union somehow found its way to the Nicaraguan Contra rebels," said a World Herald article on May 21st, 1989. And we're going to continue with discussions of allegations of connections between this case and the Iran-Contra scandal. We're going to do that, however, in the second half of the broadcast. I've made allusions to other broadcasts. Those are available from a tape and CD duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. And there's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is compiling the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming on one website, wfmu.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory. There are older broadcasts available for download but not streaming at http://archive.wfmu.org/archive/D=X/. That concludes Side A of For the Record program number 318, Kidding Around, Pedophilia and Organized Child Molestation in the Republican Party, being recorded on July 29th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.